And I absolutely love and am incredibly grateful for the opportunity. I also have to tell you that there are probably some people within the audience tonight who could do this much better than I could. But they're sitting at the table and I'm up here. How I like to do these is, it's kind of like a storytelling time, you know. It's basically not just a bunch of slides and that kind of stuff. There's an entire story involved. And I'm going to see if I've got a clicker that hopefully is working. If I turn it on, it probably would, right? So, now, this isn't really a part of our history except for one thing. I'm going to ask Jim, if you take a look on the screen and if you use the mouse to go to that little horn there, and if you push it.
You know, I said many, many times a long time ago, there are men without a dream moving half the man, and the fellowship without a vision are quarks. I still believe that. But I know damn well that we can find our fulfillment in living a day at a time here. And a day at a time, our vision and our fellowship can become a bigger reality.
So, that was Jimmy Kay speaking at the 20th anniversary dinner, and where he really talked about the vision that he and a lot of our its earlier members had about the fellowship becoming something worldwide. And but before we get there, and before we get to the point of talking about just exactly how much of a reality that truly has become, we need to go back. And pretty well everybody knows about Lexington by now. Lexington is no longer really a secret, more or less. But I really want to go back a little bit further. There are records that show that at the turn of the 20th century, that there were, so you have to understand that at that point, the opiates were available freely. There was no laws against them whatsoever. And the U.S. government had figures where there were 300,000 people who were addicted to opium and to morphine and to its various derivatives. And because they were becoming a real drain, one of the things that resulted from it is the Harrison Narcotic Act of 1914 that essentially said it is illegal to possess, use, or distribute opiates and cocaine except via medical prescription. Of course, one of the things that happens is that the people are still addicted and now it's illegal, so all of a sudden now people have to do things that are illegal, and they have to do illegal things to get the money to obtain it. And so there becomes a drug problem. And there becomes a drug problem that becomes a criminal problem. Up until recently, the earliest knowledge that we have had of any kind of treatment or any kind of attempt to provide some kind of treatment for those who were addicted to narcotics was actually Lexington. Well, apparently, there is a story that has been verified that in the state of California, there was a blue ribbon panel that was put together in 1925 that resulted in some recommendations to the legislature in 1926 that said you essentially need to have two kinds of facilities for those who are addicted to narcotics. That you needed to have a narcotics hospital for those who could be cured, and how they determined that you could be cured is if you had a willingness to stop. And the hospital stay for those people would be envisioned for about 9 months, and that you would need some kind of a work farm for those who had repeated problems or who were not willing and it will be for a much longer time. The governor at that point in California was somewhat of a penny pincher, and he said, we can't do both, so we're going to do one. And so they set up a hospital that was in a small town called Spada, that is now actually a part of what became known as Pomona. And they set up this kind of a hospital, and the medical director of that particular facility was a Dr. Joyce, who was also the head of that Blue Ribbon panel. There are stories of him who talking about the fact that at various times he believed that people could be cured, and the incredible trials and tribulations that he felt when somebody relapsed and ended up and asked to come back to the hospital. And almost invariably, their answer would be no, except for very, very few exceptions. And because the so-called success rate that they had measured was only 15% by 1932, they decided to stop the program, and the state of California basically went back to its normal way, which was incarceration. At the same time that this is going on, within the United States government, the chairperson of the Senate Judiciary Committee calls for what's written here is a constructive program that would help to combat the drug evil. He also called for special narcotics farms where addicts would have specialized, individualized treatment. And during this time, the number of federal prisoners just continued to rise and rise and rise and rise. So in 1930, the federal government created the Bureau of Prisons. However, the Bureau of Prisons had decided that they don't want to deal with the treatment of the addicts. So the government was basically looking around, and they finally landed on the U.S. Public Health Service, which then opened up the first U.S. narcotics farm in Lexington, Kentucky, 1935, and then in Fort Worth in 1937, I believe. And this particular slide is staying up here for a long time for a simple reason. 1935, there was another significant event. Alcoholics Anonymous is born, and it's beginning to grow. And there are some people who are beginning to find sobriety and ongoing sobriety. And there are some people who are beginning to believe that the 12 steps could possibly be applied in some form to drug addiction. So one of these people that is mentioned within the story in the Saturday Evening Post is a member called Houston, who meets Dr. Tom Mooney. And he believes that he has a friend who's in Lexington, who has been remanded to Lexington because of his drug use, and he believes that perhaps the 12 steps could possibly help. So he calls up Lexington and speaks to Dr. Victor Vogel, who is the medical director, and says, I've got an idea. How about you let us start a meeting inside the facility where basically we could use the 12 steps to help the addicts. So February 16, 1947 is the first meeting of a group that became known as Addicts Anonymous within Lexington, Kentucky. They call themselves the Narco Group. And it had moderate success, sufficient success where in 1948, the facility in Fort Worth decided to take it over. You had some years later, some state prisons in Lorton, Virginia, And then we're going to talk about, again, back to California, about something that is really interesting. There's a very simple list, 1946, the introduction of what became the 12 traditions, 1951, the formal adoption of the traditions, 47 and 49, Danny Carlson in and out of Lexington, starts NA in New York. Well, it's so much information, and I got to tell you a little bit story about it. Danny Carlson came from New York and was a seven-time loser. And each and every time that he went through Lexington, he believed that he could go back out there and do it better. And each and every time he'd get busted, and each and every time he'd end up back there. However, the seventh time, he got it. And he believed that he found something within that experience that he could take back with him to New York. And so he went back to New York, and within a short period of time hooked up with the Salvation Army. They essentially started that first Narcotics Anonymous meeting at 535 West 48th Street in New York. And it was with the help of Major Dorothy Berry of the Salvation Army. And there were significant differences from that version of Narcotics Anonymous to basically what we know as Narcotics Anonymous. The most significant of those, obviously, was the affiliation with Salvation Army. There were many people who believed that actually Narcotics Anonymous was a service that was offered by the Salvation Army itself. In the meantime, words of what's going on is getting out. Alcoholics Anonymous is continuing to grow. It spreads over the country. There are various members, in various states, who are trying to do something to apply the principles of the steps to help addicts recover. One of these individuals is in Los Angeles, Eddie Tom, who has a group called Habit Forming Drugs Group. They never really considered themselves a fellowship per se. It was a pretty religious based organization. However, there is a great emotional love affair between Betty Tom and Bill Wilson because of basically what Bill Wilson has done for her life and what she hopes for the lives of many others. And there's a lot of correspondence going back and forth between the two of them. And in the meantime, there is a group that is called Addicts Anonymous within East Los Angeles that is meeting. And there's an individual there who is very powerful and very much of a leader by the name of Cy Malice, who becomes very important later on within this story. And most everybody knows that Jimmy had found recovery in 1952, and he absolutely loved to make coffee within that group in North Hollywood. For years afterwards, he would say that is continuously his favorite commitment, is just to be able to make coffee. And there are words going around that, you know, that there are various attempts to start something for addicts. So basically, Jimmy is not having too much of it. He really doesn't want to get dragged into it. In the meantime, there's an Alcoholic Anonymous member named by the name of Jack Prost, who has some contacts with the police department. The police department is asking him, could you please start something for addicts? Could you please get them off the streets? Could you please help them to do something? And Jack is trying, but he doesn't understand why the people at his meetings just continue to fall asleep. He just doesn't get it. So He also attends the North Hollywood meeting, and he asks Senator Jimmy to help as well. And everybody knows about August 17th, 1953 as that date, but there were like 6 weeks of wrangling before about how to do it and who's going to be involved and where and all of those kinds of things. Cy Malice, by the time, let's see, is basically also involved with these groups. So we need to go back to the key, because there's, Jimmy continuously states that our purpose was taken from the key. And there's a very important statement that it contains, that this is an informal group of drug addicts banded together to help one another to renew their strength and to remain free of drug addiction. Our precepts are patterned after those of Alcoholics Anonymous, to which all credit is due. And that material stayed within our literature for a very, very long time. And this particular newsletter is a newsletter that is being put together by those members of that Addicts Anonymous group in Lexington, and they're sending it everywhere. And as a result, there are various groups within various prisons that are being started up by the prison wardens, essentially along the same kind of lines. Once again, we're talking about not freestanding groups. It's always under the auspices of the prison. It's always supervised. It's always watched. It's always observed. But they're essentially trying to do it. There are continuous stories of that particular version of Nazi Addicts Anonymous and the Danny Carlson model. And I hate to say that, but that particular model of Nazi Addicts Anonymous that came out of Lexington, that because of Danny became really well known nationally. His story became a national story. And I can't remember whether it became a part of his story that even after he started it, he relapsed a couple of more times, and he ended up back in Lexington twice more, and it was only after the ninth time that he finally surrendered. So there are versions of Nazi Addicts Anonymous called Narcotics Anonymous that are popping up in Cleveland, where I believe that there are some historians that can attest to the fact that there's a Salvation Army outreach program called Narcotics Anonymous into the late 1960s that was alive. And back in California, and of course that's a Saturday Evening Post that talks about Danny's New York NA. And I do need to mention at this point that they pick up one of the greatest advocates for them, basically in the body of a Jesuit priest who became one of their greatest advocates, who is Father Daniel Egan. He writes the book, The Junkie Priest. It becomes a national bestseller, and it talks about Narcotics Anonymous within New York. 1953, summer, the planning meetings. This is a picture of Frank and Doris Carnahan's home, where the papers are finally signed, August 17th, 1953. Something which is here, and here's the interesting thing. There is nothing mentioned here about the 12 traditions. Everybody has heard the story about the San Fernando Valley Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, groups. That's how it was originally thought, and then Alcoholics Anonymous had basically written back in September of that year and said, yes, you can certainly adapt the 12 traditions and you can certainly adapt the 12 steps, but you cannot use the name Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's when it became known as Narcotics Anonymous. Jimmy at one point says that He has a late night conversation with Danny Carlson, just to basically find out what's happening with Danny's group. And he finds out that he really doesn't like the way that it's being done because of the whole issue of affiliation with Salvation Army, but he really loves the name. And so we have Narcotics Anonymous. Now, this next one is a flyer, and it is also something that is published in the local newspaper. And Jim, this is a little bit longer piece. Right up on top of that, over on top, and I gotta tell you, I absolutely love this piece.
We were getting into the program, and I'm so afraid of the law, but the newcomers were scared to death. I made a sign, we put it outside the front door of the church there, about twice the size of this, three times the size of this. So, and they're meeting tonight 8:30. And we'll go to business. And we get about a dozen alcoholics in there. We came to help us. And in a car, we pulled out around the corner. Slowly. And they look at the sign, and they slip. Nobody questioned nobody, you know. They thought it was safe out. They wouldn't believe us, we told them. There was no surveillance. And we weren't just too sure in the beginning ourselves, because as a group, we decided that we were going to get it right with the law, at least we were not the Narcotics Division. And we told them, we didn't ask them if they could. We told them we were going to have a meeting about it. And they raised their eyebrows a little bit, and they started mentioning it, but there were 5 minutes down there. And whether I get ready to the lieutenant or captain, he listened and he said, it's about time something like this happened. I've been trying to help that extra year, but no success. I can't help anybody. And so he called in the lieutenant to listen in on our conversation and see what he thought. And he was a hard-nosed, old-style, open-eyed cop. So we knew for sure, that none of this could be published, you know. And he listened. And Miller was saying, I like that idea. I'll go along with that idea. And if I have a chance to say, I'll do everything I can to help you. All the way down the line, he's all for it. And he kept his word, by the way. And he said to this lieutenant, what do you think? Came our word. Was that junkie or was that junkie? You know that got that. There's never that young money get any better. I don't care what you say. No. I don't care what these people say. It ain't gonna work. So he looked back at us and I don't know what that would say. You know, I don't know what to do. I looked at Doris, she didn't know what to say. Frank didn't seem to know what to say. An old Pat who was sitting right there, whose mouth shut all this time and never opened his mouth, says, Lieutenant, my name is so-and-so. I was born and raised in such and such a place. I got arrested the first time for such and such a thing. And I was sentenced such and such a time for so many years. And starting there, I want you to go back and check my record all the way through. I mean, in every goddamn federal pen, except Dan Mora and the country, of the last of the and I haven't had a bit of junk for 18 years. I haven't been in jail for 18 years. And this program works for me. Now look it up and prove it to yourself. Because I was never out of jail from the time I was a kid until the time I found this program. And the guy didn't know what I had to say. That was our meaning to check it out. Well, the guy who checked it out, I don't know, but I know the police department, the Narcotics Division, kept the word to us. And they never state as that. They never busted it in any way, shape, or form. They never asked it.
So, October 5th, 1953, is everybody able to read what that says? Pretty well. It says, this was the material that was taken from the key. And then a final paragraph said, it shall be the purpose of this group to endeavor to foster a means of rehabilitation for the addict and to carry a message of hope for the future to those who have become enslaved by the use of habit-forming drugs. Starting Monday night, October 5th, 1953, each Monday night thereafter at 8:30 p.m., at the corner of Cantera and Clyburn, Sun Valley, California, directly behind the Sunland Lumber Company. And that's the building. And they had that first meeting, and supposedly about 7 people showed up for that first meeting. By December of that year, the vast majority of the people who signed up for that original steering group had all resigned. And one of the people still involved was Ty Malice, who came from East LA and who had been extremely active with Addicts Anonymous. And Cy was extremely gregarious. He loved spotlight. He loved to be out front. Jimmy was exactly the opposite. He just wanted to make coffee, leave me alone, let me know how I can help. And Cy just loved to be out front. And they got into head-to-head. And pretty soon, there were no more meetings at Cantera and Clyburn. And some of the MSC members knew a doctor who ran a sanatorium being for alcoholics who wanted to dry out. And it was Doc Shire, and his sanatorium was called Shire's Dryer. It's supposed to be Shire's Dryer. Okay. I messed up my own slideshow. Okay. So anyway, I will get to Shire's Dryer. So there's this first meeting in 1953. This is the first piece of literature that basically we're aware of that essentially contains the steps. It contains the prayer just for today that is here. It's virtually unchanged since the beginning, and it included 20 questions, and that was about it. There is no sign of the 12 traditions anywhere. Back to Shire's Dryer. So Doc Shire was basically one of those individuals who really believed that there could be hope for addicts, and who really wanted to assist us. And his way, though, was never charge us any rent, give us all the donuts and coffee and zoom zooms and wham whams that we could imbibe, be as free as possible about when we came and went and all of those kinds of things. And it really became problematic. Jimmy at one point talks about the fact that it became so much of a problem that he refused to go. And I got to tell you that this was the only known Narcotics Anonymous meeting at the time. Outside of this, there were those things called rabbit meetings. And what a rabbit meeting was, that a group of people would meet at somebody's house, and afterwards, just like a rabbit, they would jump back into the hole and pop up somewhere else, 2 weeks later, and have a meeting at somebody else's house. And that was the only other thing going on. Betty Tom was still trying to help addicts with CHFD. There were still some rumors that Addicts Anonymous was going on. But this particular meeting was there on a pretty regular basis. Jimmy stopped going. Cy was essentially the person in charge. And in Jimmy's material, it says that towards the fall of 1959, Cy comes to Jimmy, walks into the kitchen, slams down the keys, and says, "I'm done," and walks out. And for all intents and purposes, at that point, Narcotics Anonymous, as we know it, dies because there are no more NA meetings. And there are no meetings until 1960, when Jimmy and some of the other members, Sylvia and Penny and a few other people, say, "We've got to find another location." And they basically end up at the Unitarian Church at Rhodes and Moore Park. And they decide that at this point they're going to start a meeting that is going to have the 12 traditions as a part of the meeting format. It's going to be read at every meeting, and it's going to be a part of that particular group, and that they are absolutely adamant that Narcotics Anonymous will never again die. And Jimmy is absolutely convinced, and so are the other members, that it died for those months because there were no traditions that the group had followed. This particular meeting really became known as the mother group, for lack of a better term, for many early members, because this was the one place that they could go back to. It continued to meet at the same location until it finally closed down. Let's see, I think it was in the late 1980s or 90s. And funnily enough, the name of the group was called the Architects of Adversity. And this is the early meeting format. And if you take a look down on the bottom, it says, at the end of the meeting, leader will read the 12 traditions, then have secretary give report. Now, for those of you who have heard talk about his story at times, you will find that this is actually the second meeting that he finds, because he does end up at Shire's Dryer for a meeting or two because of his wife, who very much wants to get him into some kind of recovery. "Please, Bob, do something." And he ends up in Shire's Dryer, but he also ends up, so let's see, back in prison. And he ends up in Tehachapi. And a part of his story is that he hears again the NA message of recovery within the first H&I meetings that are taken to Tehachapi. Then we have the first little white book. And while we say that it's 1962, the writing on it started in 1960, but it really didn't get published. It didn't get copied and distributed until 1962. Now, there's an interesting story, and I'm hoping that somebody can clarify for me one day. The original piece, if I go back for a second to here, so there's the Studio City address. But there are some versions of this one that also have a San Diego address. And the interesting thing is that I can't find anywhere, and I'm not sure anybody's been able to find anything from 1950s in San Diego, except perhaps if somebody knew a printer down there, or somehow it got stamped, or it got stamped later on and basically distributed. So that's one of those mysteries, and I got to tell you, we have many of those. Okay. Now, usually at this point we talk about Walla Walla and we'll talk about Tehachapi and all of those kinds of things. I really wanted to do something a little bit different and talk about the entire... There's a little story about what's happening with Narcotics Anonymous behind the walls. Because we've already heard that It's going on as Addicts Anonymous in Lexington, that there are various groups in state prisons. And most recently, we found out that there was a study that was done from San Jose State University in June of 1958 that talks about a study that was after 7 months after a group had been formed of Narcotics Anonymous within Soledad Correctional Facility in California. This particular study talks about that there are over 100 members attending to meetings, that there are four meetings a week, that 3 months into the project they find that the Spanish-speaking people are leaving the meetings pretty early, so they start Spanish-speaking meetings, and now they are staying. Now, certainly we can't believe that this is Narcotics Anonymous as we know it, but it's just another example that Lexington experiment, which was known as Addicts Anonymous, by the time that it got to Soledad, the terminology had completely changed to Narcotics Anonymous. That's a pretty interesting thing. The very first Narcotics Anonymous H&I meeting, where people from the outside actually go in from an established Narcotics Anonymous community, occurs in Tehachapi, which is about 100 miles north of Los Angeles, and as I said before, that's where Bobby attends meetings and then comes out and basically goes to Rhodes and Moore Park. One of the things that they started doing actually in the 50s is that Jimmy loved to use a tape recorder. I mean, he was him and Gene Haig and other people just loved to actually record meetings. And that was one of the ways that they communicated with anybody who wanted any information about Narcotics Anonymous, is that they would tape a meeting and then they would send it off. And apparently they had started doing that with a group of people who were incarcerated in Walla Walla State Prison in Washington. And that group becomes the first institutional group that we know of. It's actually freestanding. They're completely essentially on their own. And they start communicating with Jimmy. And for those of you who have a copy of the history CD that we put together for the 50th anniversary in San Diego, that actually has a pretty good sound bite from one of the meetings that was being held at Walla Walla. If you don't have it, if you go to www.na.org, the entire CD is there and it's yours. Download it. Enjoy. 1962, Yucca and Gower, Hollywood is the second regular and stable NA group. And again, it's important to say stable. Lots of meetings start up. 2 weeks later, there's nobody there. I've got to tell this story. Okay. I had the opportunity some years ago to go through Jimmy's archives. And I was going through the archives, and I was doing this at night, and I'm noticing this old piece of cardboard, water damaged, all kinds, and I'm only seeing the back of it. I'm going, what in heaven's name is this? I turn it around, and there's that. That was in 1997, and we all believe, and we've talked to Bob about it, and he agrees that that was from the 1950s, that Jimmy did that, and that these markings, that those were directional markings. For any of you who have seen a map, So you can see directional markings that look exactly like that. If you take a look at the let's see, white inside the letter A, there's a very small dot, and to him that is God, and he believes that a group without God is a group that is lost. But for those of you who were around in the 80s, there was a major controversy about the four markings on the outside of the logo. And there was a significant motion to remove that because Narcotics Anonymous should not be affiliated with a religious organization. It was perceived as the Christian cross. And it wasn't really until this that we had anything that could show that it was actually directional markings, that he believed very strongly that Narcotics Anonymous would have the opportunity to spread worldwide. So that was pretty big. The Board of Trustees, Jimmy formed the Board of Trustees. He essentially talks about it, writes about it, that he just basically grabbed people and said, you're going to be a trustee. And he believed that that board needed to be set up for essentially two fundamental purposes. One was to make sure that Narcotics Anonymous never again died, that it would continue to grow and flourish, and second, that the trustees would be the arbiter or the guardian of the traditions. Now, this particular document here is actually a draft that he drew up in 1969 that actually mirrors the Alcoholics Anonymous version of just an organizational document for some kind of a service structure. And Jim, there's a right on the bottom. Thank you.
And those people we call what I call the best of service, Narcotics Anonymous. Mostly anybody who takes the position of any kind of leader, whether it's the chairman of a group, representative, other group, GSO representative, trustee, or anything else regarding this organization, just lets it go through for a lot of ways. By criticism, a lot of those other things that go on. You see me after the drill and I told you that God doesn't carry these things because the life that is given to us makes everything worthwhile.
Friday nights in Manhattan Beach. The meeting is still there, and it's been there since the middle 60s. If you're in Southern California, and if I'm not doing anything on Saturday, call me up and I'll take it. It will be a fun time. It's a crazy group, and they know how to do a meeting. This was kind of important because if we go back here, okay, so you'll see that there's that design, and then in 1968, he puts together this particular logo that eventually became our logo. And there was some kind of an evolution, and unfortunately I can't find too much about that. He drew that apparently while he was in a hospital with tuberculosis. He was apparently extremely sick from about 1967 to about 70, 71. And it was a particular pattern that would repeat itself repeatedly. The precursor to the NA Way, the voice, which would come out occasionally monthly, occasionally annually, and sometimes not for a year or two, and then sometimes for 6 months in a row. It was pretty fun to see the original lithograph it's a machine that these things were cranked on. And this is important also because Narcotics Anonymous is beginning to spread. And it's already spread to Northern California, and we could talk about the development of Northern California at length at another time. But I really want to spend a few minutes talking about the first meeting that we know of that was east of the Rockies. And it's a story of Roy and Rob, for lack of a better term. Roy was an addict who was living in Pennsylvania. He was a youngster who tried to attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and felt like a round peg in a square hole. Just did not fit in. But he would continue to try, His parents wanted him to succeed. They sent him out to California. He meets some people. He tries to attend an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in Palm Springs. Again, square peg, round hole this time. Still doesn't fit in. Doesn't like it. There are some friends of his who are working with him in treatment, back in Pennsylvania. So one of them hears about that there's a young people's convention that is going to be happening in California, and so they decide to go together. And he goes to the convention, and he apparently meets a couple of people who have a little white booklet in their pocket that they're reading. And he sees on the cover that it says Narcotics Anonymous. And he starts talking to them, and he starts to feel that there's a possibility and there's hope, and he hangs around with them for about 3 or 4 days. They print up 20 copies for him, and he goes home. And he talks to his friend, who happens to be working with an Eagleville hospital, which is in Philadelphia. And he was working in Eagleville Hospital as a counselor. And this counselor had convinced the hospital to give Roy a chance to actually have a meeting. And so the very first dominancy meeting that we know of occurred at Eagleville Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1968, or actually 1969. Roy doesn't stay clean. He ends up relapsing. Happens is that he finally surrenders in 1973, and he's picked essentially out of the gutter by these brothers, who just take him, under their wings, and the three of them start a meeting, the first meeting in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1973, and the stories are that many, many times it was just the three of them. But they continued to have their meetings. So, Mike and Danny, yes, were the Umsi brothers. So this is going on. Narcotics Anonymous is growing. There's a need. There are phone calls coming in to Jimmy's house. There are tapes going out. There are requests for literature. There seems to be some kind of a need to get something organized. So the trustees decide that what they need to do is that they need to hold a world convention. And so they send out an invitation to all known groups, in 1971, to hold a Narcotics Anonymous convention at La Mirada Country Club, in La Mirada, California. And essentially the purpose of the convention is to establish a World Service Office and to hire a manager. And it becomes important to understand that because for the next 5 world conventions, the very last day of the convention, they would hold a service meeting. And that's where they would make decisions basically on behalf of the fellowship. So there's the registration for WCNA 1, WCNA 2. The purpose of this convention is our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon NA unity. And it was in 1972 that there are some important speakers and speeches being made at that particular convention. Site of the Second World Convention, the American Legion Hall. I'm not sure that we could hold the IT track in there, but that was the World Convention. Jimmy designed this in 1972, actually 1971, and he presented it at the convention for the WSO. And this was the basis of self-service God. And it basically went along with his vision for service. The very first office, as we know it, was Bob Barrett's house on Crenshaw. And I mean, it's been all over the place. Sun Valley. Here's a picture of Jimmy and the boys at that point in front of the Vineland in Sun Valley. It's been next to suicide prevention centers. It's been next to Palm, you know, and the one steady place where it's always been until 1983 was basically Jimmy's house. There are many, many stories that his kitchen was more of an office than any other location at any time. The people always knew that the coffee pot was on and that basically Jimmy was willing to talk to you about anything and everything. WCNA 3, 4, and 5, they actually begin to have a convention outside of Southern California. They have one up north. And in 74-75, Jimmy and Greg Pierce, who by now have formed the first ASC in San Fernando Valley, and in fact that the second area service committee had started in the South Bay area, they decide that there's a need for some kind of a service structure document. And so they put together what became known as the NHCNA tree, and they decided that they needed to bring together representatives from every single community to approve it. But first, the trustees had to approve it. So they approved it in April. And the purpose of this particular convention and World Service Conference was to establish a World Service Conference and to basically approve the NHCNA tree. And, you know, there are stories about the following conferences. The next year, nobody showed up, you know, so the Second World Service Conference was a non-event. But in the meantime, the fellowship continues to expand, and it's actually beginning to grow outside of the United States as well. Jimmy's son, Jimmy Jr., is in the Army. He ends up in Germany, and he ends up talking with the base commander about the possibility of starting up NHCNA meetings for those on the base who wish to attend. So there's a need for a German little white booklet. Where is it? Anyway, there's a German little white booklet. I apologize. This thing got screwed up, I think. There's the German little white booklet. So this is a translation that Jimmy had done professionally. However, it stayed in effect for many, many years until problems with language came up. And it became the first real indication about why you don't want to have professional translators translating our literature. However, you do see the MC cross that is there. Now, at the same time, there are various versions of the little white books. The one in the middle is not a little white booklet. That is a piece that was put together by the Northern California Fellowship that Jimmy went ballistic over because he called it a plagiarism, because it was a direct copy of Alcoholics Anonymous' version of This Is AA, with just basically changing names and terminology. However, it was in fairly wide distribution up there, and it became one of the major points of contention between Northern and Southern California. That continues in some form. IP number 7 in 1978, it finally grows beyond the 20 questions, and it becomes more involved. The conventions go on. The conventions, the world conventions, are essentially within Southern California and Northern California. And some members start to attend from Philadelphia. They start to attend from Texas. They start to attend from various spots around the states. But there's an argument. There's an argument about the, I mean, it's the 8th World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. It's generally held that it was going to be held either in Northern or Southern California. But at that convention, there's a group of people from Houston, I believe. And there is this, the people who are voting on it are split. Half of them want it in Southern California, half of them almost want it in Northern California. This group from Houston throws in a bid for consideration. And so the First World Convention outside of California occurs in Houston. And of course, I mean, one of the things that occurs in Houston is that there is a member from Marietta, Georgia that Jimmy has been communicating with by the name of Bo S., who's adamant about certain things that need to occur, and Jimmy really likes Bo, but he's put off a little bit by the level of enthusiasm that this young man seems to have. And so he decides that in Houston he's going to put him off on Greg, and basically Bo and Greg form a great friendship. And from that particular meeting, you actually have the first couple of meetings of the World Literature Conference, and on the bottom of this one is the last little soundbite that is Bo trying to explain to the next World Service Conference about why we need a book.
So much needs to be done. So much needs to be said about the program that has numbers that is not included in the end account, but that what is needed is a book. My own feeling is that the day a book comes out, it's going to go into circulation on the limited capital anyway. So why not go to the throat of the matter and give it to the book?
Grab it by the throat and go for it. So, it's the members cutting and pasting. This is a classic picture. It's a classic picture. I want my sentence in there. Okay, it can go in here. But these were the literature conferences. The third one and the fourth one, the Memphis Lit Conference. There's Bo sitting behind the typist as he is listening to Greg dictate the traditions. So I don't know if you can see it, but there's Bo holding a telephone to the typist as he's talking to Greg in Oregon about how to write Chapter 6. The gray form. The gray forms are to be mailed. The approval form that Stuart showed the copy of, the reproduction of. The approval form of the personal stories. And then these are pictures from the 1982 Amatsi World Service Conference. And this one shows Steve B., who is the conference chairperson. And the motion on the blackboard is to approve the basic text. Yeah. Okay. Red and Blue. How many of you have seen the red covers? Cool. How many of you have one? Okay. How many of you have a good copy of the blue that is in pristine condition? Okay. This one. So let's see, what is really not known, these were supposed to be the collector's items. There were only supposed to be 2,500 of those printed, and there were supposed to be 5,000 of the others printed. Well, they ran short of money. So it was 23 and 2,500 that were printed. And because the blue covers were the ones that everybody used, if you could find one that hasn't been written in on every page, it's actually more valuable than basically a red cover these days. So how many of you have not heard the story about what happened with the basic text and why we have five editions? Okay. Okay, there are a couple. Okay. One of the things that occurred, Jimmy, according to the story, let's say one night is basically reading the galleys. Thank you, sir. God bless you. So let's see, he's reading the galleys, which are the blue lines, the final print before it goes to print. It's the blue lines, it's the final approval time. He notices some material that he says, this can't be right. He calls up, at that point, the chair of the board of directors and the chair of the board of trustees and the chair of the conference and says, we've got to do something. And so they make a decision amongst themselves to change that language and to go ahead with the printing. 1983, at the conference, there are people from WSCLC who are ripping up the book in front of the conference because they are saying, this is not the book that the fellowship approved. And immediately call for Jimmy's dismissal and for the original version of the book to be published. And one of the things that occurs is that at that particular point in time, Jimmy is dismissed. The parliamentarian at the conference, Bob Stone, is hired as the next manager of the World Service Office. Who moves us to Van Nuys, which you saw previously. And basically I'm rushing because I think I've only got about 5 to 10 minutes left maximum. I can talk about this for hours, but unfortunately there's only so much CD time. And so what happens is that there's an agreement. They're going to go back to the version that was approved by the conference and at the same time have a group tally. Send out a referendum to every group asking them whether they wish the first edition or they wish the original version, which by now is the second edition. The results come back. It's close, but it's the original version that was printed, the first edition. The problem is, in publishing, you can't go backwards. You can only go forwards. So therefore, the next printing of the basic text becomes the third edition, which is identical to the first edition. Okay? Following that, Narcotics Anonymous continues to come of age. There are concerns about our language. There are concerns about the fact that why are we talking about so many drugs? Why aren't we just talking about addiction and basically it's just drugs? The Board of Trustees they're given the task to take a look at our language. They come up with some significant changes to the little white booklet. It's in 1986, which of course ends up in revising the basic text, because the basic text is based upon the little white booklet. So you have the third edition revised. There's also a supplemental motion asking that there be a copy edit done on the book. Well, the copy edit now becomes the fourth edition, and there are typographic problems, there are other problems, too many of which, if you have 5 hours, I'll talk to you about them, but there are many problems. So by 1988, we are up to the fifth edition of the basic text, which has been in existence for 4.5 years. And what occurs is that the International Fellowship that is beginning to develop, saying, which version would you like us to translate? And so therefore the conference in 1988 begins a series of moratoriums about having no changes to the basic text for a specified period of time. And there was a moratorium that essentially lasted for 20 years. And it was in 2008 that moratorium was eventually lifted, and that we ended up with the sixth edition. So that's the basic text story. And I could do it all kinds of ways. But anyway, this is the final picture. This is the final time that Jimmy addresses the conference. There's the various copies, the Board of Trustees in 1986. Interestingly enough, some of these members are still with us and still very much in service, and unfortunately some others are not. The gentleman on this side is Mike Bohan, who was a naval doctor who helped us tremendously, because there was a belief that if we could have people who weren't necessarily addicts, who could speak on our behalf in a particular way that no addict ever could. And Mike Bohan was not the last non-addict trustee, but he was certainly one of them. Japan is continuing to grow. This is 1986. You'll see a slide later on where they're celebrating their 20th anniversary. The first East Coast Convention. There's Australia, 1986, London. Let's see, I want to tell you a story before the end. Here's your new World Service Office. Various events around the world. The first fully bilingual convention in Colombia. Celebrating 20 years of Japan NA. This was a public relations trip to China. Basically we were invited to participate by the World Health Organization. This made me prouder than hell, so that's why I just continue to include this, because I love the flag of NA right next to a flag right outside of a convention center in San Diego that says we are 50 years old. The PR efforts, NA in Eastern Europe, so you've seen a lot of this particular story I want to tell you. There's two parts to this, and there have been, Iranian members in Narcotics Anonymous for many, many years. There are members in Southern California who have 25 and 26 and 27 years who have had Parsi-speaking meetings. And some of them have been very instrumental in doing some of the translations into Farsi, which is the only language of Iran. And some of them have gone back at times and have taken back literature. And I think it was 2003, 2004, that we started to hear the story that there's this explosion, that there's this veritable explosion of meetings happening within Iran. And so we sent a couple of members of the board to check it out. And representatives of the Iranian Fellowship were basically notified a few days in advance. And so they had a little welcome party for them that had 12,000 people at it. which blew them out of the water, which we couldn't believe when they came back. And many people have asked members of the board and the office, why can't the Iranian experience be reproduced? And it's a really unique situation. They had an extremely active involvement on the part of the health ministry and some professionals who absolutely wanted to have Narcotics Anonymous succeed. They didn't want to be a part of NA, they didn't want to do any of that material, but they wanted NA to succeed. So because of the nature of how that country is run, how much time about? Three? Okay. I'll make it quick. They knew that it was the clerics that were really in power there. And so they asked one of the Ayatollahs to review our literature to find out if there was a conflict between our principles, Amnesty and Islam. And this cleric wrote an opinion that was published nationwide that said that he had found that there was absolutely no conflict whatsoever. As a result, Narcotics Anonymous had gained doors that were wide open. They have tent meetings, hundreds of people in the park. We had a representative of the Iranian Fellowship who had been granted a seat at the World Service Conference, the previous conference, who was able to show up this last conference. And he stood in front of that body. I'm sorry, it's... And he thanked the conference on behalf of his 300,000 members in Iran for the gift of recovery. And I got to tell you, you know, that was like last year around this time, and it just chokes me up. Because that original group logo, that original vision, that Jimmy had, that service vision that we have, that Narcotics Anonymous be recognized worldwide, and that no addict anywhere be denied the opportunity, is becoming a reality. And that is as much a part of our history as basically what happened 50 years ago. So I wanted to share that. There's a 12-step tent city that is outside of Tehran and Nairobi, Kenya, and, you know, I mean, it's everywhere. It is everywhere. We are in 138 countries. We speak 68 languages. There are 57 ongoing translation projects going on right now that are active, and 220 waiting to become active. This is our fellowship. So, considering that we came from... it's you guys' fault, you know that, right? Let's see, I don't become this emotional. But I believe in this fellowship. Because it not only gave me my life, and it not only gave you your life, but it continues to do it every second of every day somewhere around the world. So, anyway, time is up. Thank you. The Florida region had indicated that that they're going to make many of these presentations available, afterwards. And I would be more than happy to send you this PowerPoint cleaned up, in order, the way that I actually wanted it in order. And thank you. Thank you for allowing me to do this.